This is WGN Radio. We're produced by Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams. Our first guest today is Michael Miller, Associate Professor of Economics at DePaul University. Welcome back, Michael. I hope you're well.
I am doing well, John. It's great to be with you again.
You were writing about women in the workforce, and it actually touches on this conundrum we've been dealing with all year long, and that is, when do those unfilled jobs get filled? And there's maybe woman in the workforce perspective that we should pay attention to. What's your point on this?
Yeah, economists have been puzzled by some of this. Some of it's clear it has to do with home health, taking care of people at home, taking care of children. We knew that that was keeping women out of the labor force during the pandemic, and the effects you would have with childcare problems, that there was a shutdown of many childcare areas. But Tom Barkin at the Richmond Fed, he focused on two really interesting ideas. One had to do with what is called a mismatch. And a mismatch is where the people in the job market don't have the skills necessary for the jobs that exist. Now, you would think if it's something just like, I'm a machinist, but I don't know how to use that particular machine, you know, at least that person could be trained to maybe use that kind of machine. But when it comes to the women versus men issue, a lot of it has to do with there are simply jobs that are open during the pandemic in manufacturing, construction, and so forth, that are jobs that women historically and currently simply do not want or don't feel qualified to take. So they don't want to be on a roof doing roofing. They don't want to be doing construction or fishing or logging. And these are areas where there are job openings. And so this mismatch is much harder to get around, mm-hmm. because it is a matter of personal preference that could take a long time to adjust the labor market to the people in the labor market itself.
I guess if I'm not in that industry, I don't notice that as much as the sign on every restaurant door that says help wanted start immediately, or daycare centers, things like that, jobs that women have gravitated towards, right?
Yeah, see, that's correct. That's why we knew that women really had the brunt of the pandemic, because they held a lot of jobs in leisure and hospitality. It is this mismatch, though, with the things like construction, because those jobs really did not have the downturn that we saw. To this day, they are the strong sectors of the economy. But, you know, even if there is a help wanted sign, the other thing that Barkin focused upon was what he called an incentive issue. Let's say that someone is at home taking care of children and maybe even extended family in terms of seniors and so forth who need assistance. When a woman would go back to work, she would receive an income, and some of the support that she would be getting from the federal government while she was off work taking care of other people, she will lose those benefits. And in some cases, there are cases where people who go back to work actually lose more money in federal benefits than they receive in the income that they get from the job that they take. Mm-hmm. And so he was talking about this incentive problem, that you never want to have a tax on work that is over 100%. I mean, it's just downright silly that you would go to work and you would actually lose money as opposed to earn money. And that we can deal with. Congress can deal with that when people do go back to work, and we are going to reduce the federal benefits you receive because your income is going up, we need to find a way that allows the benefits to be reduced in such a way that they don't discourage people going back to work. You don't lose $1 for $1.
So in other words,
maybe the answer is 50 cents or 30 cents or something per dollar of income. But the economists focus on incentives, and we cannot have disincentives for people to go back to work.
So when you do go back to work, don't reduce the benefits so much. You know, a lot of people look at that scenario. They may not think about it the way you just put it. What they do say is, well, clearly the benefits were too generous because they are greater than what you would make when you are employed at whatever this job is. And you and I talk about this all the time. I take a little exception to that. Maybe the benefits were too generous. I'll have that conversation, but maybe the pay is not good enough either, or the work environment is not good enough either. I still think it's an employer problem as much as it is a benefits issue.
You know, I'm beginning to come around to that idea because I think that workers, in some sense, have been shortchanged over the past couple of decades. There is some evidence that their pay has not kept up with their productivity. And so workers getting higher pay now and having being in a stronger labor market position, I think, is a good thing. And I'm not convinced that I think I'm actually in your camp, even though we politically disagree. I think I'm in your camp that that the benefits are not necessarily too generous. What has to be done is there has to be a way to come up with a system which keeps those incentives in place to go back to work, mm-hmm. yet assist people when they still need help.
Hold on, I'm writing this down. Michael Miller. And if you don't mind, I'm going to call my family as well, so stay right
there. Yes, I don't blame you.
Talk to me about inflation, Michael. How bad is it? Are people going to be able to keep up? What's the story here today?
Well, when it comes to inflation, you know, economists still have not pinned down exactly what is going to happen going forward. There are still two major opinions. One is that we are in for a very rough ride and that prices are going to continue to rise because of supply chain problems and the money that's in the system. And this is supported or endorsed by somebody as competent as Larry Summers, who was Obama's advisor. But then you have almost the entire Fed, who argues that while inflation's going to be high, say, for the next couple of months, it's going to then subside coming into 2022 and everything go back to normal in terms of price increases. Now, what's happening, of course, is we always look for culprits. Who's to blame for this? And one place that people sometimes point is the worker, that any time that a firm has to pay more for its inputs, whether it be crude oil or some other kind of raw material, or workers, they'll pass that on to the final consumer. And so some people have come to the conclusion that an increase in wages is inflationary. And I find that quite disturbing because there's simply no evidence to support that workers are the cause of inflation. From everything I have seen in terms of the empirical work, and this goes back both in terms of theory and empirical work, that workers do not have the ability to anticipate inflation and demand increases before it occurs, which then feeds the inflation. Workers react after the fact. They say to their employers, look, inflation was 5% this past year. You need to give me a 5% raise. Well, clearly the worker cannot be the cause of that 5% increase because their wages didn't go up until they were trying to recover what they already lost. So there is this debate within the discipline and within the business community, are workers the ones causing the inflation? And I think the answer is clearly no. Kansas City Fed has decided has argued that the labor market is not nearly so tight that it would cause some kind of labor-related inflationary pressures. And even if we did find that the labor market was very tight, it is that workers always get their pay increases after the inflation, mm-hmm. not before the inflation. So it's not a wage price spiral. It would be a price wage spiral. And I know that distinction sounds trite, but in fact, it's quite important that the workers cannot be blamed for what's happening in terms of inflation.
Well, I think I understand that chicken or egg argument you're making, but then what if it's the egg? Like what is it that causes the costs to go up that the workers are responding to? Do you know what that is?
Well, economists would argue that several things could be causing this. One would be there would be an unexpectedly large demand that had been, in a sense, pent up. Yeah. People hadn't spent, and that's part of what's going on, that people simply want these things after not wanting them for a while. And if supply cannot keep up with it, this will bid up the price of goods across the board.
Yeah.
And the second, and now this can occur, of course, and this is why people would sometimes point to, say, the Biden proposal for an extra couple trillion dollars in spending. This will be spending that, in some sense, will be funded by the printing of money. because the money will be borrowed, and the Fed is going to buy much of that issue. And it is that increase in the money supply, plus this sudden increase in demand that could come from this piece of legislation, that could cause the inflation to occur. So some people will blame the spending. Government spending does not cause inflation unless money is printed to fund that. And it looks like that could be the case. And therefore, if anything is a culprit, you could, in some sense, point to a possible increase in spending put upon the economy by the government's policies.
But the Biden administration is also planning to pay for this infrastructure bills by increasing the taxes on people of high net worth or high income and some businesses. What's your guess on what happens then?
Well, then you would see that would not be necessarily inflationary, because the increase in spending that would be done by the government would be offset by a decrease in spending by those who have to pay the tax. You see, the government spending in and of itself is not the source of the inflation. It's whether or not that government spending is funded by borrowing, which takes it out of the hands of other people, and that's not inflationary, or if it's done by the printing of money. And if it's done by the printing of money, that the Fed is the one who lends the money to the government, so to speak, then that can be inflationary. That can be spending for which there is no offsetting production. And when you don't have as many goods being created, then the prices of those goods are going to go up when demand is that strong.
Will cars then still be expensive, new cars, for the next couple of years, because we'll have pent-up demand and supply is nowhere near catching up?
Yes, that, I guess that could certainly be the case. And as long as that, to use that word we used before, as long as that mismatch exists, it will cause pressures on prices. That's correct. Now, see, what we normally argue, of course, is that these higher prices would lead to maybe higher profits, which would lead to people investing in more car production. But if you can't get the parts, you can't get the computers, it's a real problem. But we are seeing the price of certain things beginning to subside a little bit. And that's why I'm with the group that thinks that this inflation is temporary. It may take us into early 2022, but I don't see it going on beyond that, because I think these matters will be settled. I'm not convinced that Mr. Biden will get all of his requested spending. I think he'll get some of it. And I think the Fed will be doing less printing. There will be more borrowing and higher taxes, which in and of itself is not as inflationary.
Yeah, you keep making that point, but you don't say if that's a good idea or not. Like, I'm okay with taxing the billionaires and the zillionaires and maybe even some businesses, because I'm none of those. 30 seconds, yeah. Michael, what's your thought about that?
I'm not as much in favor of taxing. To me, the tax system is already quite progressive. Mm-hmm. And the only way the federal government's going to raise the necessary money to increase the size of, in a sense, the welfare state, is if the taxes are paid by the middle class, not by the rich, because the rich already pay a vast majority of all the taxes.
Well, then I don't like it at all. Okay, well, then
I know that.
Michael, yes. It's nice to talk to you as always. Thank you for your time.
It's great, John. I enjoyed this very much.
And your expertise, sir. Michael Miller is an associate professor of economics at DePaul. Jim Dahlke, senior editor at Chicago Inno. Hi, Jim. Let's get started. How are you today?
Good, John. Thanks for having me.
Now, Cameo is a fascinating little business here, and they just keep getting bigger and almost smarter and stronger, don't they?
Do so. Cameo, in recent years has really kind of become the poster child of Chicago's startup scene. Just earlier this year, raised $100 million in new funding, valuation more than $1 billion. Really fast growing company here in the city. And what they do is they connect you with celebrities. So they on their platform allow you to purchase personalized video shout outs from well-known famous faces. And they've been doing that for 4 years now. And just today actually made their first ever acquisition in a company called Represent. Represent is an LA-based startup that's created a platform that allows celebrities to sell T-shirts and other sort of custom merchandise directly to fans. So This is really kind of the first move by Cameo that gets into an e-commerce space sort of beyond video messages. They launched direct video calls with fans not too long ago, but this is kind of the first time that Cameo is going to be able to sell you something that's more tangible and physical beyond just a video message. So the company says that down the road they believe that, you know, they'll be able to sell you bundles essentially. So if you do a Cameo with Arnold Schwarzenegger, for example, you can do a video message from him and a t-shirt.
$1 billion, that's still an amazing number to me. And so it wouldn't be, say, something from the set of an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, but some Schwarzenegger-branded T-shirts or merchandise that have been created specifically for this purpose? Is that what you're saying?
That's right. So Represent launched back in 2014, really as a way for kind of, you know, influencers and celebrities to, you know, sort of create these custom T-shirt designs and sell them to fans. And, you know, they've actually really caught on. They've worked with some pretty big names like Jennifer Lopez and Ed Sheeran and Leo DiCaprio. They're actually the official sort of T-shirt platform for the Friends reunion on HBO recently. But they also work, you know, beyond the sort of A-list celebrities. They also partner with TikTok stars and YouTube personalities, which is actually a big piece of what Cameo does as well. You know, there's celebrities popping up on all corners of the internet, right? Not just on the silver screen. So, you know, what this acquisition I think allows for Cameo is, you know, famous people to continue to, you know, earn money off of their likeness. And it doesn't have to just be the A-list movie stars, right? It can be these TikTok stars as well.
Thinking of the kids from Chicago who started a business where college athletes, after they graduated, were able to sell their merchandise, their uniforms and jerseys and sneakers and stuff like that on the secondary market. There were no NCAA violations because they had graduated. But I think the market for that might be a little popped now since the NCAA is loosening up its restrictions on current athletes as well. So maybe there won't be the market for that.
Yeah, that's the Players Trunk. Yeah, we've covered that startup a bunch here in Chicago. Really interesting company. And yeah, now that the NCAA changed their rules, that they can sell some T-shirts as well. So they're a pretty interesting company that has actually seen quite a bit of traction now that players, current players, are able to sort of sell gear as well. So we'll have to see how, you know, the March Madness tournament and some of these other big, you know, college events that sort of propel their business once they get into the spotlight.
Yeah, okay. Well, I wish them well. I like their chutzpah. And if the current rules enable them to continue to do what they're doing, more power to them. A funeral at a bar or a movie theater. This is a piece you wrote about how maybe we're changing the way we remember people after they pass away. What's going on here?
Yeah, so this is a story we did on a Chicago startup called Lighten. And what they're really kind of doing is helping you sort of, you know, reimagine the funeral home experience. You know, a lot of folks don't necessarily want the traditional sort of somber funeral home experience when celebrating the life of a loved one who's passed on. And actually, they're kind of piggybacking on some U.S. cremation data that's really interesting. Last year, the U.S. cremation rate was 56%. That's up from 32% in 2005. And by 2030, it's expected to be about 73%. So kind of what that allows is for families who aren't doing the traditional casket and burial to sort of do a memorial service really wherever they want beyond the funeral home. And that's really what Lighten is all about. So they're creating different live experiences, essentially party planning for funerals, where they create a bunch of different custom experiences for folks to celebrate a loved one who has passed on, whether that's at an Irish pub or at a movie theater for somebody who was a big movie buff, or in a backyard or a courtyard or a ballroom or a gallery. They really kind of want to offer a different range of experiences for folks that don't kind of want that sort of, you know, sort of dingy, somber funeral home experience. And they're catching on. Last year, they did a lot of virtual experiences as well. So, you know, a lot of families couldn't gather in person. So they were saw their business really kind of grow on the virtual and hybrid side of things by providing video services. But now that people are willing to get back in person, they see a big opportunity in live experiences.
And that business is called Lighten, L-I-G-H-T-E-N. All right, out of time for today. Jim, we'll catch up again later. Thanks for your expertise, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks, John.
Jim Dahlke is the senior editor at Chicago Inno. 12:44 on the Wintrust Business Lunch. More business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. United Airlines says it's spending about $1.4 million every 2 weeks putting unvaccinated pilots on paid leave because their colleagues refuse to fly with them. The airline made the disclosure in federal court where a judge has issued an order barring United from enforcing a vaccine requirement. The company wants to place those unvaccinated pilots and other employees on unpaid leave if they don't get their shots. United reported a loss of more than $7 billion last year because of the pandemic, and revenue has been slow to return. The CEO of Walgreens Boots Alliance says the drugstore chain is well on its way to reinventing itself as an integrated healthcare company. Roz Brewer, who took over earlier this year, has also set a target of 11 to 13% long-term growth in earnings per share. Cranes reports that's four times the company's average pace. In recent months, Walgreens has acquired majority stakes in three healthcare companies, including the recent investment in primary care provider VillageMD. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
With the business of food, here's Steve Alexander.
Yeah, our buddy Lou Manfredini has a role in today's business of food. Many years ago, he introduced me to the Misericordia Home and the force of nature who runs it, Sister Rosemary. She's been there 50 years now. If you don't know about the good work that she and everybody else at Misericordia does up on the city's northwest side, here's a quick overview.
We serve more than 600 children and adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and we have programs that cater to their strengths, and the bakery remains one of our most popular work opportunities for the residents. And in the bakery, currently, we have between 50 and 60 residents pretty much helping with any of the day-to-day tasks in the bakery and our packaging room.
That's Beth Wojtek, the bakery manager at Misericordia's Hearts and Flower Bakery. And that bakery is an easy way to send Thanksgiving and Christmas presents to family and friends. All sorts of cookies and breads and other sweets, my favorite of which is the chocolate brownie in the shape of a heart, Misericordia's logo. Oh, those are so good.
They certainly are. They are one of our best sellers, and people are certainly keeping our brownie cutters busy.
And they'll be busier as Misericordia is expanding.
We are finishing up construction. It's going to be called the Hearts and Flower Bakery and Cafe. It's a standalone bakery just down the block from our Northside campus on Ravenswood. So a whole new concept for us.
Misericordia.com. You spell it MISERICORDIA. And you can see all of the great things to order there. You've heard about shipping problems, so do it sooner rather than later.
Early and often, as the Chicago way.
And as you're placing that order at Misericordia.com,
don't forget to click the donate button to help fund all of the amazing programs we have on campus.
Beth Wojtek, bakery manager at Hearts and Flower Bakery at Misericordia. And I'm telling you, those heart-shaped brownies will set you free. Mixed bag at the Chicago Board of Trade right now. Beans have been up double digits today, up about 13 cents now. Corn has been in the red most of the day, down about a quarter of a cent. And wheat is trading about 3 cents higher. From the farm to your belly, today is National Greasy Foods Day. Just saying that makes my belly hurt. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Jamie Guth joins us on Mondays at this time. Let's talk about Hertz and what they're up to. Amy, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, John. Happy Monday. So indeed, Hertz has announced that they're going to buy 100,000 electric vehicles from Tesla. So that makes it one of the largest battery-powered car purchases in history so far. And really, you know, AP broke this story, but they pointed out that this is really the latest evidence of our increasing commitment to electric vehicle technology. So they're going to turn this around pretty quickly. So deals, terms of the deal weren't really announced, but if you want to do kind of back of the envelope math, if they're about $40,000 a piece, that they're using the Model 3 vehicles. So they're kind of estimating that this deal might be worth about $4 billion. But they said they're going to be ready some as early as November for rental. So customers will have a choice. They, you know, they have already some hybrid vehicles in the fleet, but they could say, hey, yeah, I definitely want to get a Tesla at this this destination when I'm on this trip doing this thing. And Tesla is saying they're going to kind of double down on their own infrastructure so that consumers and renters can be a little more confident in renting an electric vehicle, because I think that's a big point of pushback. A lot of people are like, well, but I don't know if I will find a place to plug it in. I don't know about that. So Tesla will kind of help with that and make some of that infrastructure exist a little bit to help those Hertz rentals.
100,000. I mean, for Tesla,
it's a lot. Yeah,
I was surprised they've got 100,000 ready to go, or will. That's quite a commitment.
Yeah, we'll see how long it takes to deliver all of those, indeed, but it probably not all at once. But yeah, that's a big number. I mean, the other kind of big number we look at is the 10,000 electric vehicles that Amazon wants to buy from Rivian. They're kind of awaiting delivery on those. They have a contract in place on that. And that was a really huge number when that deal got announced. But now 100,000 Teslas, that's quite a big buy.
And I don't know about you, Amy, but when I rent a car, I really don't think so much about it. I make my decision somewhat randomly, and I get a rental car, and I get a midsize or whatever it is I need. But if I knew Hertz or some other company, but Hertz has the Tesla, I think I would look into that. That would be fun to try and drive. I mean, that's just brilliant on both their parts.
You know, I was thinking that very same thing, that, you know, the opportunity to, hey, I could drive a Tesla for a couple of days and see if it's for me. There's sort of this built-in marketing campaign with doing this, because if people are, you know, how many times have you driven a rental car and thought, oh, this is actually a nice little ride, right? I'm like you. I don't really think much about it. I just kind of get the car I need and off I go. But sometimes then later you see that car on the road and you go, you know, that was a good handling car. I liked driving that thing around. So it'll be interesting to see kind of what that does with consumer sentiment as this rolls out.
Update us on the supply chain for Christmas. What are you hearing about that?
Yeah, so we talked, I think, about a week ago, maybe a little more, about Best Buy creating this membership site program where for $200 a year, you'd get kind of early access to some stuff. You would also get some lower prices and some other perks and things like that, kind of capitalizing on it's no secret that it's going to be a really tough time for holiday shopping this year due to supply chain issues. So Walmart has announced something similar. So they announced earlier today that members of its Walmart Plus subscription service, you get a 4-hour head start on Black Friday deals. That's an interesting move, kind of alongside Amazon has been promoting its Prime early access feature. So you get kind of early access to deals, and they even started doing some Black Friday deals already. So Walmart's kind of joined that group of, kind of this, if you join this club, we'll give you some extra access or lower prices or both to goods that we all kind of recognize are going to be a little bit harder to get this year.
Well, that sounds smart on their part, too. Amazon is also doing something for hospitals and senior care facilities. What's that?
Yeah, I thought this was a really interesting story and a really great use of this technology. So they've announced the Alexa program, which is, the voice control electronic assistant. They're doing this for hospitals and senior care facilities. So essentially, a facility would have one network that would allow all the devices in the building to be connected to it. So it wouldn't be everybody needs their own account. It would be there's the one account, and then there's maybe 400 different pieces of, and each person has their own Alexa in their space, in their hospital room. And so they're using that as a way to maximize productivity, but also to help residents, say at a senior center. You wouldn't need a staff member to help you call a family member. You could just say, hey, Alexa, call my grandkids. And there you go. But it could also help contact nurses. You know, there's like the nurse call button, but you could also, the nurse could check in right away and say, what's up? What do you need? And you could let them know what you need so they can come to you more prepared. But it would also allow for a do not disturb option. So a patient that needs a little time that you don't want a nurse or somebody dropping in to check on you, you could just say, I need a little space right now. So I think that's kind of an interesting use of that technology to use in that kind of group setting.
By the way, we apologize now for the 10,000 phones that are ringing at grandchildren's across America.
Right.
That's on Amy Guth.
I know, that's my bad.
It's hard to do those stories sometimes without doing that. And it's an interesting story. And again, it sounds like another good idea. Thank you, Amy Guth.
Thanks so much. Have a good one.